Off and on over the past year, I've had a writing project going on, one of two or three that I tinker around with, really, whenever I find the time. This one is a family memoir. It began at a writing workshop I attended summer before last, and primarily focuses on a series of summers from my childhood, which I know I have alluded to here in sermons from time to time, summers that I spent on a small farm in Ohio with my grandfather and two uncles and an aunt who were siblings, a sister and two brothers of my father. Since you've already heard me allude to this, all of my maternal relatives lived in England, owing to my mother being the British World War II bride. Because my father's side of the family was really the only one I had any kind of ongoing contact with when I was growing up. My contact with my maternal family was mostly, I was always glad to get Christmas presents, birthday presents, cards, and things like that. Well, while I began with what was mostly in this writing thing I was doing, it began mostly a humorous recalling of what, for me, were a series of idyllic summers. The more I wrote, the more I found myself being led into increasingly deeper territory. The project took on something of a life of its own, began to write me as much as I was writing it. I found myself even pushing back a few generations, clear to the post-Civil War era at times, and into certain areas of rural southern Appalachia from which my ancestors have come. Using what I knew of family records and stories, combined with what I allowed my imagination to supply when I didn't know what was going on there to fill in the gaps, I kind of keep up with this multi-generational narrative. With those Southern Ohio summers, which ran from about the time I was 5 or 6 years old until I was about 13, with those summers kind of being a home base, and then here and there I would go beyond those summers to later stages of my life. Over this past year, you probably heard me refer to, at times, the importance of being able to locate ourselves in a larger narrative, larger narratives, actually, like those of family, or culture, or country, even up to a cosmic ultimate narrative or story for those who wish to take their explorations that far. Well, now you know many of my references to the importance of narrative have come out of this attempt I've been working on over, the last year and a half to recover some of my own. And I should throw in a quick caveat here about the sermon itself. Like the narrative I am describing, this sermon, as I wrote it, also kind of took on a life of its own, which I decided to let it have. That happens every once in a while. And so while I will speak of the issue of family politics in the course of what I have to say today, as it's turned out, it's not my main theme after all, and now you know that too. To continue for just a bit longer with this story of my writing, it's kind of fascinating. For the more I kept writing, or as I said, the more I kind of let this project go where I wanted it to go, where it seemed to want to go, the more I found myself attempting to uncover just various layers of family stuff. Now, I've always known those layers were there. I just never probed them all that much. I should say that I am not talking about horribly gothic kinds of layers or horribly gothic kinds of things like, you know, dead bodies hidden in an upstairs bed, like you get in William Faulkner's short story, A Rose for Emily, one of the weirder short stories I think I ever read. Yeah, you know, nothing that weird, nothing that disturbing, just some few little subterranean kinds of things that I wasn't tuned into in my earlier years, tensions that never quite reached the surface, and some things here and there that, well, we just don't talk about that. For example, my grandmother, who died several years before I was born, most likely, as well as I can put it together and have talked with other folks, most likely succumbed to the effects of Huntington's chorea, same disease that killed Woody Guthrie. The effects of this disease in its final stages are so debilitating and so painful to witness, and my grandmother was never institutionalized for it, that very little was ever even said about her entire life. And I never knew very much about her. For the prolonged manner in which she died was so disturbing to the family that her life itself was seldom or rarely ever discussed. So I found part of what I was doing was I tried to give my my grandmother alive. Tried to imagine what her life had been like up until the onset of Huntington's. It was also kind of interesting to realize how I had dodged a bullet. She did pass it on to one son who never married, which means it stopped right there. And it wasn't until I realized that I had kind of dodged a bullet from my grandmother's illness as well. The aunt who had nearly as much of a hand in raising me as did my mother had been briefly married in the early 1940s. And since the stigma around divorce or around a failed marriage that time was so strong, I never knew what it was about or how it affected her. So I decided I would recreate the story of her marriage based on my very scant knowledge. There was one of my uncles who, as a young man, was amazingly handsome, had a real killer smile that I discovered when I found an old studio portrait of him, done sometime probably in the 1920s, 30s. Was there a side of him that simply was not allowed to find expression, given the time and the culture in which he lived? I will never know. And then there was me. As I was cruising through those childhood summers, being doted upon by truly loving and caring relatives, there was this kind of below-the-surface tension going on about how I could best be raised. My mother, coming from another land and another culture, was embraced on the one hand, but eyed a bit suspiciously on the other. This cute little British lass who had charmed my father into marriage when all he had set out to do was go serve his country in a time of war. Who is this lady and who is this kid she's bringing back here into this family? Could she really raise me right? Even though she married R. Gordon, could she really raise me right in the Eddington way, whatever that way was? So the thought was, maybe we need to take little Stephen under our wing and do the best we can with him, which is really how I ended up spending all those summers there. Well, anyway, I've gotten out a book-length narrative on this, and there's much more that I don't need to get into now. And whether I'll try to even publish the thing or not is something I'm still in the process of deciding, seeing as how my mother had kind of rather mixed feelings about it when I let her read it all. You know, you can get to be nearly 65 years old, and moms still rule. But one thing this little memoir exercise has done for me, above and beyond my trying to uncover some more of this story, is to remind me of what a complex and multifaceted, multi-tiered institution the family writ large actually is. For I would guess if any of you were to set out and do a similar exercise to what I've just described, and maybe some of you even have, you would, on the one hand, find yourself telling a story that is unique to you, but you'd also find one that I would imagine has a universal dimension to it as well. And the universal part would be, as I've just alluded, just how many layers of story, how many layers there are of narrative in the family histories that have brought each of us to where we are at this point in each of our lives. As I said earlier, I didn't find any of those layers I mentioned to be terribly devastating. Instead, they helped to reveal some of the wider reaches of what is also my story in ways that in the end were positively insightful, even with some disturbing pieces here and there. So moving on then, and expanding upon this matter of the complexities of families, I offer a few lines from an essay that was published quite a few years ago now, but still quite timely, by the social and political commentator Barbara Ehrenreich. The title of the essay is called, Oh, Those Family Values. Much later, Ms. Ehrenreich wrote a really good book called Nickel and Dimed, which I commend to you as well. But this essay, Oh, Those Family Values, speaks very well to the often highly conflicted attitudes we as a culture and society take towards the family. Here's a brief excerpt. Theoretically, and oftentimes actually, the family nurtures warm, loving feelings, uncontaminated by greed or power or hunger. Within the family, and often only within the family, individuals are loved for themselves, whether they are infirm, incontinent, infantile, or eccentric. At best, the family teaches the finest things human beings can learn from one another, generosity and love. But, she then continues, it can also be where we learn nasty things like rage and shame. Americans act out their ambivalence about the family without ever owning up to it. Millions adhere to creeds that are militantly pro-family, but at the same time, millions of others flock to therapy groups that offer to heal the inner child from damage inflicted by family life. Well, playing off of these words, I'm aware that offering a sermon on the family, whether it's Mother's Day or not, can sort of have the quality of kind of walking into a minefield. But I figure there's nothing wrong with an occasional minefield sermon once in a while, just to, well, keep me on my toes. So knowing what I do of the many life stories, the many pathways that a good number of you here bring to this congregation, I do know that invoking a topic like family calls up a wide range of thoughts, emotions, and memories that do reflect what Ms. Ehrenreich observes. For many of you, Laurie spoke to this in the words for reflection as well, for many of you, some of your most cherished thoughts and feelings derive from your family of origin and or the family you're a part of today. And I can truly put myself in that category, even as I acknowledge some of the less than perfect aspects of my family of origin, knowing, as we all do, that there is no such thing as a perfect family. But for many of us, those families were and are indeed places where your love for yourself, where you were taught those finest things human beings can learn from one another, generosity and love. I know for others, the term evokes memories and feelings that are less than positive, or that recall unresolved conflicts and continuing tensions. All of these things, all of these paths, are what you bring here to this congregational family. So to narrow this down on what is a very broad topic, for the next few minutes here, I'm going to focus on a couple of areas. First, I want to look at some of the needs and expectations we bring to both the families in which we are raised and the ones we attempt to create, and how we deal with the reality that those needs and expectations probably will never be completely and fully fulfilled. And so as not to abandon the topic completely, I will look at some of the ways in which I see the institution of the family being politicized in ways that do stigmatize and indeed deny full civil rights to certain segments of our population. To take on that first one first, whenever I conduct a service of dedication and naming, we bring a newborn child before us here in this congregation or before a circle of family and friends, I lead off with these words. Each human life is bound with others, and this is especially true within the family. In the relationships of family, we receive our sense of worth and personhood, our sense of what is right and wrong, our feelings of who we are, and what our unique place in this world is. Even as I say those words and believe them, I'm also aware that they do ask a lot of a very human and a very fragile institution to shape and form a person, to engender a sense of personhood, a knowledge of right and wrong, a sense of one's unique place in the world. These are big expectations, but this is what we expect from our families. And through all the stages of our life, we want them to be that basic unit to which we can look for acceptance and support and personal affirmation and respect and trust. And yet we should do all that knowing that the family is also the most human of our human institutions, meaning it is subject to both the best and sometimes certainly less than the best of human beings. Some of us come out of family settings where we primarily feel gratitude that those needs and expectations of which I've just spoken were to a large degree fulfilled. And perhaps others of us are looking for ways to come to terms with the fact that they were not, or are looking for ways to forgive those who were unable or unwilling to be about the meeting of those needs. In a book called Traits of a Healthy Family, psychologist and therapist Peter Collier observes, "The family is what you've got. It's your limits and your possibilities. Sometimes you get so far away from it, you'll think you're outside its influence forever. Then before you figure out what's happening, it will be right beside you, pulling the strings. Some people get crushed by their families. Others are saved by them. Crushed, saved, or some of both." Dr. Collier makes a very wise observation in noting that your family of origin is something you never completely walk away from. And this brings up what I consider to be the greatest irony in terms of what is needed or expected from one's family of origin. However constituted, however weak or strong, functional or dysfunctional, crushing or saving, it still is the institution, it is the social unit against which, or in the face of, we define ourselves and take responsibility for ourselves. To close on this one point then, families are very human, oftentimes very fragile institutions, in which we invest a great deal of need and hope and expectation. Some of us, as mentioned, have had those hopes and needs and expectations met better than others. And however fragile families may be, most of them are still resilient enough to survive human failings. And many times those who are victims of those failings are still able to go on to create healthy lives and healthy families of their own. One of my many hopes for a religious community such as this one is that it be a place, it be a setting, where we can bring whatever lives our family journeys have accorded us, varied as they are, and be a place where the inherent worth and dignity that they each and all, these lives each and all contain, are affirmed and promoted, and done so in a way that we can each take the best of those journeys, however much or however little of those best parts they may be, and continue here with one another to grow a life. To touch very briefly on that second point, I find it both interesting and at times maddening to see how the family writ large is so readily invoked as a means of resisting and providing opposition to what I would consider, anyway, so much of progressive social policy. The cause of woman's suffrage, which we had mentioned to us last week, Reverend Baruch touched on it last Sunday in her portrayal of Antoinette Brown Blackwell. That cause of woman's suffrage was resisted on the grounds that it was anti-family, that it would undermine the family to give a woman a voice and a vote in the public arena. Anti-miscegenation laws, which forbade persons of different races to marry, were justified on the basis of preserving the quote-unquote purity of the family, as if a mixed-race marriage would somehow render a family impure. And this month, should you be looking for an anniversary to celebrate or to observe, this month marks the 50th anniversary, back in May of 1960, when the Food and Drug Administration approved the sale of the first oral contraceptive for women, 50 years ago. And even with that, it took a Supreme Court decision, Griswold versus Connecticut, 5 years later, in 1965, to strike down state laws that prohibited married couples from, married couples no less, from obtaining this legal FDA-approved drug. And the basis of those laws, most of them religiously based, maybe not overtly religiously based, but most of them religiously based, was that the fundamental purpose of the family, that of procreation, was being undermined by the use of so-called artificial means of birth control. That was the idea, that you couldn't, that even though that was a religiously based thing, it had worked its way into our secular law so much that it took a Supreme Court decision to overturn it. And most recently, as we have seen, the efforts to deny same-sex couples the rights of legal marriage are also resisted on the basis that granting such rights undermines the traditional institution of the family. I would say what those who over the years and decades and centuries have used, those who have used this save the family argument, in each of the cases I have just cited, do not seem to realize or do not seem to recognize that the family is a dynamic rather than a static institution. Its makeup, its role, its many functions have changed and evolved over the course of human history and will continue to do so. That's a topic for another sermon, but the family doesn't stop, hasn't stopped at any one place in human history. It has been an evolving and dynamic thing. I will close on this point by simply saying that what really undermines the worth and value and dignity of the family is when it is used as a political tool and a political club to block full access to certain fundamental human rights, as I feel it was done and is done in all the instances just cited. For today, I will begin to wrap this down by expanding on something I said earlier. I want us to be here, a welcoming and affirming religious community for the many kinds of families and individuals who have made and are seeking to make this their religious and spiritual home. For whatever families have brought each of us to this point, the fact is that we are all here now, coming with both the fulfillments and the frustrations those families have bequeathed to us. We come here with memories of them that we cherish, or with memories that are difficult or painful to recall. So I think we need to be mindful as well of the many kinds of families that make up the members of Mosaic of our congregation. There are those who find much of their energies going into what I refer in child dedication services of the sometimes joyful and sometimes agonizing process of being parents. And there are those couples whose family life consists of their life with each other and the enjoyment they derive from that, whether they're past their child-rearing time or have chosen never to go that route. There's a single-parent family contending with both the challenges and the rewards that are found in that setting. There are same-sex couples, some raising children of their own, some not. And there are those who choose to, or for any number of reasons, find themselves living alone and who come here for that larger sense of family that I hope we can continue to offer. And there are, I am sure, family forms and shapes that I'm no doubt overlooking. I hope we know that all are welcome, all are valued. In conclusion, then, the charge I give to families in a child dedication service that I spoke about earlier, I think it's one that applies to all of us as we share our community here, to be a place where we receive our sense of worth and personhood, our sense of right and wrong, our feeling of who we are and what our unique place in this world is. For we each and all carry these needs with us from the moment we embark upon life until the moment we take our leave from it. So may we continue then to find amongst ourselves new and creative ways of living out this charge, so may each and all move to greater levels of personal fulfillment and continue to strengthen the bonds of our congregational family. Let's sing together, "Touch the Earth, Reach the Sky." It's number 301.